Questions, comments, concerns, thoughts. Cell phones are off. Cell phones are off. Cell phones are off. She's not looking at me. All right. Let's do this. Let's do it then. Cell phones are off and tucked away. Yes. No eating, no drinking, putting it on, sugar all the way on your feet. No sleeping, no pimple popping, no hair growing. We good?
All right.
Hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Bill Kurowski presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Morning, everyone. Please have a seat. Just as a preliminary matter, Justice Rebecca Bradley is on the phone. Justice Bradley, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, and we can hear you as well. I do have my phone, and Justice Bradley knows she can text me if she has questions. Also, before any of the speakers sit down, I'll just do a double check with her to make sure that all of her questions get answered. If I forget to do that, anyone in this room, please feel free to remind me. I don't want to forget. I want to call the case today, but I'm not sure how to pronounce the last name of the petitioner. Is it Rabina?
Rabina.
Rabibna. Okay. People always pronounce my last name wrong, and Justice Protasewicz's. You're in good company. The case then I would call today is Rabibna versus Higher Education AIDS Board. Will you please state the appearances? And I have 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay, whenever you're ready.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The retention statute solves a problem that race-neutral aid has failed to fix. Assist dramatically improves retention rates for college students from groups with disproportionately high attrition. The program satisfies equal protection because improving retention furthers the compelling interest in providing educational opportunity to our state's programs in financial aid and our technical college system. And the program is narrowly tailored to address Wisconsin's persistent retention problem for students in these groups. This court should reverse the Court of Appeals both on merits and on standing. On the merits, the case the Court of Appeals primarily relied on, Students for Fair Admissions, didn't cause the sea change the plaintiffs claim, particularly not as to programs outside the affirmative action college admissions context. And on standing, plaintiffs have neither a concrete injury, which their complaint actually conceded, nor taxpayer standing, which doesn't exist for claims like these. Plaintiffs construe Students for Fair Admissions in a way that would have consequences far beyond this case. Their reading would bar government programs seeking to benefit people of particular races, like research funding to achieve better maternal outcomes for Black moms and their newborns, or even a celebration breakfast for Latino graduates. I'm sorry, Justice Hagedorn.
When you're talking about compelling interests, are post hoc justifications sufficient, or do they need to be the actual reasons that the program was put in place?
I think that the post hoc question comes up in the context of situations where the compelling interest is a specific one, remedying past instances of specific discrimination. I don't think it's relevant in other contexts. I will say, though, that the equal educational opportunity compelling interest here is something that the 1984 committee very specifically addressed and had very much in mind as it was developing this program.
I was thinking about the diversity interest that you put forward, and obviously there's questions about whether that remains compelling interest or not. Discuss that further, but is there any evidence in the record that suggests that the interest in diversity were part of the reason for this program?
Not in 1984. One thing that's really interesting about this program is it essentially has to be newly created every 2 years because the legislature and governors have to re-up it or else it dies. So I do think that as we think about what the reasons for the program are, we have to keep in mind that this is that unique setting.
Are you aware, on the diversity rationale, are you aware of any court that has since SFFA said that the diversity rationale survives as a compelling state interest?
I am not. But I'm also not aware of any court that has looked at a program anything like this.
Council, can you go back to standing? Because to me, it's pretty clear the taxpayers have standing. And you're saying not standing in a situation such as this, when I think you know, our cases have basically recognized that the mere expenditure of public funds is going to result in standing. Can you tell me how you distinguish that?
Yeah, I would disagree with Your Honor a little bit on what the precedents say. So on taxpayer injury, there's two categories. One category is a situation, it's almost always local government because the amounts of money are so much smaller, where the injury can, where the taxpayer can actually show that his or her taxes are going to go up. So that's what you had in City of Appleton, where the court said, we found that if this program went forward, the taxes would go up. On the other side, you have what's called in the old cases, taxpayer actions, where the court hasn't, and the respondents here are right, required any specific injury on the part of the taxpayer, because he functions as kind of like a class action representative for all taxpayers. But they have an interest only in making sure that the state or city or local government complies with specific restrictions on how monies are raised and spent. It's not for any old claim at all. It's not for claims about individual civil liberties like First Amendment claims or equal protection claims. So if you go back to the cases, and these are cases they cite, so you've got Tooley, which is about taxation, Thompson, which is about property tax assessment, SD Realty, which is about whether the government was spending for a public purpose. Those are all claims about how the government is complying or not complying with spending restrictions. And in fact, if you take a look at the Wagner case, I know it's old, but it's there. The court actually distinguishes that kind of claim where they say taxpayers have an interest in making sure that those things are complied with. That was a public bidding case versus, I think the court says, there's no standing just to restrain the irregular exercise of power by public officials when the exercise in no way jeopardizes the private rights of the taxpayer. So the court even there made that distinction. And we acknowledge that the case law has gotten a little messy. And I think as advocates, we don't always do a super tidy job, but that is what taxpayer standing's for. Because if taxpayer standing just lets you bring any old claim and say, hey, I pay taxes, then our standing doctrine is really meaningless. So I do want to cover the specifically the narrow tailoring, because I think Justice Hagedorn's questions on compelling interest were helpful. And on the equal opportunity side, we have, you know, Justice Kennedy's comments in Parents Involved in Community Schools, and it's also something the trial court identified in his decision. And you have two big programs that the state has chosen to offer here. We spend about $150 million. On financial aid and higher education.
Council,
we have our.
I don't understand how the amount of money has any relevance to the tailoring argument. You know, you made that point. You know, just a little bit's fine, but I don't really understand how a little bit of discrimination, you know, on the basis of race, makes it more or less narrowly tailored, just because it's a smaller amount in relation to the whole proportion of financial aid. Could you explain that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's important in two respects. And I want to talk about other aspects of narrow tailoring too. But on the amount of funding, as the trial court found, and this is at page 45 of his opinion, that no financial dollars were lost from any race-neutral program, and the students and the program doesn't unduly burden non-minority students. So the amount being so tiny means that there isn't a burden on those who can't take advantage of it. I think it also goes.
How is that? I mean, the program discriminates on the. It makes distinction. It awards purely on the basis of race, right?
No, it's. I mean, to
get. I understand there's a secondary need component. But to get in the door is a threshold question. You need to be in certain racial categories and not other racial categories, right?
That's correct.
How is that not a burden on people who are not in the defined racial categories?
I mean, I think maybe you mean there's a psychic burden or something, but in terms of an actual concrete burden, this is why these plaintiffs don't have standing. They're not losing out on any financial aid overall that they could otherwise get. If this program goes away,
they're
same amount of aid.
They're ineligible for a scholarship program that's given on the basis of race, and they're not in the race that qualifies. I mean, that's seems pretty textbook to me, that's a burden on the people who are eliminated purely because of their ethnic or racial heritage.
But this specific pot is an infinitesimal amount of all
the. Does that have to do with whether, you know, if what does it have to do with whether you are not eligible to get something purely because of race? It doesn't matter whether it's a big amount or small amount. If you give out a dollar to people who are of a certain racial category, not to others, it doesn't matter that it's only a dollar.
It matters because it's at that point, it's a symbolic burden. This is not a situation where we're talking about spots at Harvard, and those spots are super competed for, and every spot that a minority candidate gets, that means somebody else has to pay the price, as Justice Powell talked about in Bakke. This is truly just a symbolic injury, if anything, because there's so much money out there. And I think it's important.
Some people on the basis of race, but not others, is purely symbolic if you're not in the preferred racial category. Is that your argument?
Our argument is that there has to be a concrete harm that, and I think Justice Bakke's formulation is so helpful because he's saying we're looking at people who are truly burdened in a real way. That they, so the idea that maybe there was, so the average grant here, right, is $700 for the technical college system. And the idea that there's no way to go out and get that aid. We also know that non-minorities do much better than people in these groups at getting that race-neutral aid. So they're getting boosts in various ways. So whether there's really any loss is a question. But the case law needs to make a distinction between losing out on a finite competed for benefit, like getting into Harvard or even a public contract where only one company can get it and one company is shut out, and these very infinitesimal changes.
Let me ask you a question just about the educational opportunity interest that you're putting forward. It seems to me that what you're really arguing is an interest is to have, you're defining the problem with reference to race. We're going to say on average, Black Americans, Native Americans, Hispanic Americans, and those of Vietnamese, Laotian, and Cambodian heritage born after 1975 or whatever, before them, have those people in those specific categories on average do worse in staying in school. So we're going to help just those people on average by defining the category based on race, and that the interest isn't sort of broadly speaking educational opportunity. It's just purely racial categorization and balancing. And I want to ask you a hypothetical in relation to that. So imagine that a study was done now that said that it defined a few different categories. Okay. So let's say it said in defined racial categories, let's take on average how often they're sticking in school. Chinese do the best, followed by Koreans, followed by white, followed by Indian. I mean, people from the country of India, followed by Hispanic, followed by Black, and Native Americans do the worst. If you had a scholarship program that purely gave money to white Americans and Indian Americans because they aren't doing as well as the Chinese and the Korean Americans, do you think that would be problematic?
The numbers matter, Your Honor. It's not just a matter of where do you fit in the line. For these four groups, the attrition rates are dramatically different than everybody else.
Great. Let's make them as dramatic as you want to for my purposes.
That's where the equality matters. And I would offer as an analogy in the VRA context, which Your Honor is really familiar with, one of the factors, right, is the equal opportunity of voters to access the political system. And the Supreme Court has talked about it matters whether it's just a little bit because that doesn't matter, or is it dramatically different because that's when it starts
mattering. What's the answer to my question?
Well, I think I'm trying to answer your question, which is that just being in a different place in line doesn't matter. What matters is that for these four identified groups, the numbers were dramatically different.
So let's suppose that the Chinese and Korean students do far better than any other category. Let's stipulate that. Is the program that in my hypothetical legitimate? Is that it's fostering, it's saying that these racial categories aren't doing as well as these other racial or ethnic categories. Therefore, we want to give money just to people on average in these other racial categories. Is that acceptable?
I mean, certainly if you could come up with numbers that were dramatically low, you know, that you had a standard where most people were coming in.
Right.
And then for whatever reason, white students were doing a lot worse. And then conversely, we could show that a targeted solution to correct that problem and give them an equal opportunity to these important state programs was this program. Sure, there's nothing magical about
So it'd be a compelling interest to have white students on average doing as well as Chinese students in my hypothetical.
Well, and we're not trying to reach on average the same. What we're trying to do is correct for very dramatic disproportionality.
Can you talk to that as it relates to this case? I'm wondering, because I think your friends on the other side, this is one of the criticisms they have of your position here, and that's whether or not you've cited the evidence that shows that there is actually a crisis in retention and graduation rates among the groups of people covered by the statute. So will you lay out that evidence for me?
So this is in our, it's in our reply brief where we talk about the many times they've made concessions. Now, these are factual findings, and these are factual findings the trial court made. The trial court, and just on the standard of review, obviously this court reviews the legal question de novo, but the factual findings the trial court made are reviewed for clear error. They didn't put in any evidence in the trial court to rebut the evidence that we presented from reports, from experts, and that the trial court found. And so I think we're beyond questioning what the trial court's findings were. So the trial court found that there is a retention crisis. He said it was uncontroverted. He said that the program achieves far higher retention rates than race-neutral aid at pages 9 and 41 of his opinion. He said at page 41 of his opinion that the state had tried race-neutral alternatives without success, and he cites the Bob Lang 1985 report. And as I mentioned before, he actually found that people who can't take advantage of this particular program are not harmed in their overall effort to get financial aid and college. Those are just factual findings. I'm sorry.
It was down there.
Oh, sorry, down here.
Sorry.
On that last point, I have a question. I think this goes more to narrow tailoring. The plaintiffs have pointed out that there are racial or ethnic groups left out of this statute, in particular Middle Easterners. They use the example, I believe, of an Afghani woman who may have some significant barriers and challenges in achieving education. Is there a problem here with this statute in the way it defines, who's in and who's out? Is it under-inclusive in its reach to, truly address all of the disparities that may exist?
So certainly there was no evidence presented in the trial court by the plaintiffs that there is such a group that is struggling with similar attrition rates.
Well, wouldn't it be up to the state to demonstrate that it has narrowly tailored by structuring the statute to only include the groups that it has evidence for and that there aren't people left out? Isn't that the state's burden?
No, I don't think it's the state's burden at the time it develops a program to affirmatively go out and look for every human being, especially in the context of we're legislating, right? So you had this group committee that studied.
Well, not every human being, but we're talking about broad classes and categories.
Correct. Correct. So classes and categories that the legislature, as it's designing this program, has an affirmative obligation to go out and find groups that the committee had failed to find were struggling with this problem. And we know that they were open to getting more information and because they added Southeast sure. Asians when they realized that within the broader category of Asians who on the whole were doing great, that there was this one group that wasn't doing well. So I think the key is, based on the evidence presented to the legislature as it develops the statute and then continues to re-up it as time goes by, are they responsive to learning about new evidence that maybe there are groups that aren't left out? Because then Your Honor's right. It would be under-inclusive, and they need to change the statute to add these.
So you think it would be up to the plaintiffs to show that their data, that there is such a group, or how do you see that playing out in litigation,
right,
and the challenge to the state?
Right. So I think there are a couple of ways they could go about it. To me, the appropriate way to do it would be to look through the legislative record through the years and say, look at these groups who came forward. They're struggling just as much as Native Americans say, but the statute doesn't cover them. Will you please add them? And the legislature didn't do that. Even then, I think the challenge is to, do they need to be brought in? It's not to facially invalidate the whole law.
Okay, thank you.
But there are other components of narrow tailoring that I want to make sure we touch on too. As I said, and it was found by the trial court, the program achieves far higher retention rates than race-neutral aid. So we know that race-neutral aid is not an alternative that works. And we had expert evidence on that, and we have the apples-to-apples comparison in the technical college system between students in each group who do receive a grant and those who don't. And it's dramatically different rates. I think for Black students, it was over triple the rate of retention, which is just extraordinary.
Council, can I ask a question about that apples to apples? Yes, that does show that this works for those minority students to be able to retain and to graduate from college, which is potentially a compelling state interest that we would want people to graduate and be able to function in society and pay back their loans and be contributing members. Is there, though, when you talk about narrow tailoring, don't we also need to know what's happening with the other groups? It's not just that this grant helps these people. It's how does that compare to, you know, the white population?
And how would that go to narrow tailoring?
Well, it would go to narrow tailoring to show that this is necessary, because that is, narrow tailoring is we've identified, you know, a race or an ethnicity, and in order to have that strict scrutiny, you need the compelling interest, but it also has to be narrowly tailored that those particular groups are the ones that need to be identified to have those goals met.
Right. So the,
so
the
if record- all the, like, for example, if white students would do the, would are also would benefit from that. I mean, how would you, wouldn't there need to be a comparison? And I'm saying white, but it could be any other group than the ones we're targeting. Wouldn't that also need to be part of an analysis somehow to show that narrow tailoring?
I don't think so, because I don't think we need to take on all problems at once when we devise a statute. We have people at the start of the day who are far lower in their chance of finishing even a technical college degree than non-minority populations. And we come up with a solution that helps them. I think to say, well, they can only get as high as the average non-minority group, I don't think narrow tailoring requires
far
that.
Far lower than whom?
Far lower than non-minorities, by which I mean basically whites and Asians other than Southeast Asians. So that's the start of the day. We know that. That's been conceded by them. That's been found by the trial court. And the idea that the idea that they can only get as high as what the average would have been for non-minorities without it, I don't think narrow tailoring
that
requires
what I was asking.
That stingy solution.
Okay. Yeah, that was I was trying to get at some of the information that would, if you're the, why do we need to use race? What makes it a necessary to do that? What makes it both compelling, and then what ties that to
right.
the program itself?
And so there are findings from the trial court on that too, about why race neutral aid doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. They've conceded it doesn't work. And why doesn't it work? It doesn't work because kids in these groups are more sensitive to small changes in their financial picture. It doesn't work because of differences in home equity and home ownership. It doesn't work because of reluctance to borrow. Financial aid is over half of most financial aid, or loans are over half of most financial aid packages, because of really high default rates in these groups. So people are less likely to borrow. And that the trial court made those findings too. So we know there are reasons why we know it doesn't work, and we know there are reasons why it doesn't work. And then this targeted problem solves this for the kids who receive
Council,
the scholarship.
I have a question about that analysis, because it seems to me that what the trial court was looking at and what was presented was simply that access to generally available financial aid had not reduced these severe disparities that we see, correct?
That's right.
But we know that just, for example, Black students are not failing to graduate or not dropping out of college because of the color of their skin. That's not why we have these problems. So to what extent is race being used as a proxy for some other social conditions or problems that these students are encountering as they, you know, attempt to further their education? Certainly some of it's financial, and you've mentioned a couple of things like, you know, lack of intergenerational wealth, home ownership, things like that. But do you believe the state has examined all of the other reasons that might account for these disparities? Things like being a first generation college student, attending a poor performing high school, you know, a lot of different reasons that might be driving these disparities that is not specifically based on race and ethnicity.
Right. Well, for example, being Black correlates with a lot of these factors, including right. attending a poor performing
right.
high school.
And so that's why I said, is it a proxy for other things, other race neutral reasons that could be used instead?
Yes, but there's no, at least we haven't been able to find a tool that would capture all these different components and create, you know, there are talent incentive grants and other first generation college scholarships. There are other race neutral things. And Bob Lang's report talked about other kinds of programs that UW campuses had that also weren't working. This is the one program that our experts tell us will work. And because it captures that whole confluence of things that people in these groups encounter.
And Bob Lang did that study in when,
1985?
Has there been any work done since then to, you know, any research, any further work to try to, you know, work on, and I do think that this goes to the narrow tailoring, like is the way we're trying to solve this problem the right solution to the right problem?
So the expert evidence that we put in the trial court and that the court found credible was very up-to-date evidence, and that's what our experts opined. So that's very up-to-date. I think that, you know, this program has been incredibly successful with a tiny, tiny amount of money. And I just want to say that Students for Fair Admissions doesn't anywhere say that it is intended to have an impact on programs like this one. And I actually thought the, if I can finish my answer, or if you'd like me to stop, I can.
Actually, I have a. Why don't you finish that thought? I have two questions for you, and then I want to see if any of my colleagues have questions.
Yeah, there's a great conversation in Parents Involved. So that's the case that Justice Kennedy was a concurrence on between Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the plurality, and Justice Breyer. So that's another case about a zero sum game where kids get into a magnet program based in race, or they don't, and parents are upset, and they have standing because their kids aren't getting to the program. And Justice Breyer dissented, and he said, oh, this is going to affect all these different programs, like research expenditures for diseases and policies that favor minorities when distributing goods or services in short supply, or actions that create majority-minority electoral districts. And then Justice Roberts responded to Justice Breyer and said, Justice Breyer's dissent ends on an unjustified note of alarm. It predicts that today's decision threatens the validity of hundreds of state and federal statutes and regulations, but those have nothing to do with the pertinent issues in these cases. So at least at that time, Justice Roberts saw a big difference between these zero-sum affirmative action type cases and programs like the one here. Thanks. Oh, and you said Justice Bradley had...
I have a question, but I want to check to see if my colleagues...
I have one, but I can go after you.
Okay. I want to turn to the Wisconsin Constitution for just a moment. On page 34 of your brief, you note that you talk about Wisconsin's constitutional right to education, and I would just like to hear a little more about how that applies to this statute.
Can I just take a peek at the...
Yep. Did I cite the correct page?
Sure. I just wanted to make sure we were talking about the right piece of the Constitution.
Okay.
So we think it speaks to the importance of the technical college system to the educational opportunities that Wisconsin has chosen to offer, and that this is really baked deep, deep into the fabric of our country's history and culture.
And then I have a second question, and it relates to the amicus brief that was filed by Law Forward, where they talk about Article 1, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution, which is the Equal Protection Guarantee, which talks about all people are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. I'm wondering what your thoughts are as to the how that provision of the Wisconsin Constitution could be applied to this statute, if at all.
Right. So had the plaintiffs here decided to go with just state constitutional claims, then we'd just be talking about, well, what should the state standards be for equal protection in contexts like this? Here they've chosen, I mean, they pled both, but really they've only talked about the federal constitution, and obviously we have to satisfy that. So at least for this case, there's interesting things in the amicus about the state constitution, but I don't think they would control the outcome here.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to, as precisely as you can, I'm having difficulty understanding what the educational, or what you call equal educational opportunity is as a compelling interest for the race-based classifications here. Could you, as precisely as you can, tell me what exactly the compelling state interest is?
The compelling state interest is that if a state chooses to develop an educational program that's available to everybody in the state, like financial aid and our technical college system, they have an obligation to offer that opportunity equally to everybody in the state. And they have a compelling interest in ensuring that they are doing so. Now, if there are trivial differences in how well different people or groups are able to access those things, that's fine. But when we see really dramatic disproportionalities, the ones that really got the committee fired up and said, it is long past time that we address this problem, that's when it becomes a compelling interest that the state needs to address.
And has any other court recognized that as a compelling interest for racially discriminatory programs?
No, because I'm not aware of cases that have challenged programs like this one.
Justice Bradley, do you have any questions?
Hello. Counsel, you are couching this program in terms of it being a benefit to certain racial groups. And you suggest that there's evidence supporting that it's a benefit to certain racial groups. But this program was unlawful before Students for Fair Admissions, and it's even more so, and it's more clear that it is after that case. Distinctions between citizens solely because of their ancestry are by their very nature odious to a free people whose institutions are founded upon the doctrine of equality. And that can only be overridden in the most extraordinary cases. And I don't think you've made a case for this being an extraordinary case. I don't think you've addressed one prong of the analysis, which is that race cannot be used as a stereotype or a negative. And this statute creates a financial benefit that is not available to most students solely because of their race. In other words, the statute forecloses students from participating simply because they are not the right color, the right of the right ancestry, because they don't come from originally or their ancestors, the right country. How can you justify the constitutionality of this program when it uses race as a stereotype and most definitely a negative by shutting the door to people of multiple races simply because of their race?
So I'm allowed to answer that, right, Chief Justice?
Please do.
So I have two answers for Your Honor. One is Your Honor's view of the strict scrutiny analysis, and Your Honor says both pre and post Students for Fair Admissions, is essentially Justice Thomas's view, which is that all race-based classifications are inherently unconstitutional. Obviously, he does have that view. I think plaintiffs here probably have that view too, but that's not what the Supreme Court has done so far. And then on the issues of whether race is treated as a negative or a stereotype, first of all, we think that test just doesn't apply outside the context of affirmative action in college admissions. And when you look at the specific things the court gets into on those factors, they're really specific to that context. But even if they do, I think Your Honor is not applying the test in that case faithfully to what the court actually said. So on negative, what the court talked about was that zero-sum game. That's the term the court used and talked about how Asian Americans weren't getting into Harvard because people from these minority groups were. And while there's some infinitesimal change in the total pot of money, the finding from the trial court was that it's not burdening any non-included students' opportunity to get all the financial aid they otherwise would be. This is not a zero-sum game in the context of financial aid availability. And then on whether it treats race as a stereotype, this is really specific to college admissions. Colleges were picking out an admissions class based on who was diverse, and they decided that certain races per se would count as a diverse person. And that really frustrated the Supreme Court. They said, that's not fair. Here we're using race as a marker of a type of student who is failing to persist or stay in college and finish their credential for a combination of reasons that's shared by people in this group. So we see those as both those extra prongs of Students for Fair Admissions, both as inapplicable here, but also ones that we can pass.
So is it the state's position that you think the United States Supreme Court is going to think it's okay that the state of Wisconsin denies aid to use the examples from the briefing, a Palestinian refugee, a woman from Afghanistan, all because they are not the right race or ancestry?
No, it's because there is no evidence linking their groups with significantly decreased attrition. But this is not a U.S. Supreme Court case because of the lack of standing, but it's the facts don't match the groups. It's not like in the college admissions context where we're just picking out certain groups and saying, hey, I just feel like you're more diverse than another group. That's what upset the Supreme Court.
And you're relying on facts and expert opinions that are 40 years old.
No, we're relying on facts and expert opinions that are brand new, including expert opinions that were not challenged in the trial court and findings by the circuit court, which are reviewed only for clear error.
Anything else, Justice Bradley?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Berg, as you are approaching the lectern, I'll of course do the same thing and make sure that everyone's questions get answered. And if at the end, even if your light is on and you're trying to make a bit of some closing remarks, I'll afford you the same courtesy that I afforded Attorney Gibson.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And may it please the court. So before I begin, I just want to briefly note that my oldest two sons are in the room with me. My parents are in the room with me. Clients is behind me. So go a little easy on me, if you will.
That is a nice boy.
So this is going to be a little bit of a different argument than I've normally done. I may break the fourth wall a little bit, so to speak, during the argument here. I'm surprised I'm saying this as a lawyer. We lawyers love to talk. Normally, I would have a lot to say. I don't really have anything to add from the briefing. I put all of our best thoughts in the brief. I'm happy to spend the whole time answering the court's questions if you want to, but I don't really have more to say other than what I put in the brief. What I want to do, if the court will allow it, is try to persuade you that the right thing to do in this case is to dig the case. Now, if you don't know what I mean by that, that's an acronym.
We know what you mean.
Okay. Well, so I don't know if this court has ever done that. I don't know if that's a tool that this court has used, but it is relatively standard practice at the U.S. Supreme Court. It happens somewhat regularly, and that's in part because you don't have complete information when you grant a petition. And after you dig into the case fully and you sort of understand the full complete issues, sometimes the right answer is to sort of ungrant the petition.
Why would we do that here?
So that's what I'm about to explain. So there are basically four ways this case could be resolved. One is digging it, which is what I'm urging you to do. Two is to affirm. Three is to reverse on the merits. And four is to reverse on standing. But this is a federal claim. So this court is not the final answer on this federal claim. And it is the easiest federal claim that I have ever argued. It is the lowest of low-hanging fruit now in terms of federal constitutional claims. So if this court says this is fine, this case, this program will eventually be struck down, maybe by the US Supreme Court, maybe by a federal district court in a future case. But it's eventually going to be struck down. So the question before the court is when, how, and by whom it gets struck down. And the three alternative options that you have are going to actually result in a massive hit to the taxpayers. That's sort of the deep irony here. If you reverse on taxpayer standing, that will actually be the biggest hit to the taxpayers. Because
Mr.
now,
let me ask you something. You brought this case down below. Yes, you're the one who filed this case initially.
Correct.
Okay. I'm trying to be a good lawyer and not asking a question that I don't already know the answer to. I want to ask you why you brought it, but I think your answer is going to be Student for Fair Admission was decided in the middle of this litigation, and you might have pursued a different litigation strategy had that case already been decided the way it was. I should let you answer the question, but I'm thinking that might have something to do with it.
I mean, to the question why we brought this case, because we think this program is unconstitutional and odious to the Wisconsin Constitution and the federal Constitution.
Yes.
So that's why we brought the case. When we brought it, it was pre-SFFA. Now, in our view, it was still clearly unconstitutional pre-SFFA, but post-SFFA, it's not a close question. And that's what the Court of Appeals held. So if you dig the case, what will happen is the Court of Appeals opinion will stand, and that will be the final decision in this case. Now, one of the questions I'm frequently asked during these arguments is, what do you disagree with, if anything, about the Court of Appeals opinion? So I always think about that and prep for that when I do these arguments. And the answer here is nothing. It was a very good opinion. It goes through all the facts. It goes through all the law. It goes through all the arguments very carefully. One of the best Court of Appeals opinions I've read in a long time. So yes, you
then
can
spend... Then why don't you just want us to affirm it? Why do you want us to dig it?
You can. Obviously, I would prefer a win before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But then you're spending the next 6 months essentially rewriting Judge Gundrum's opinion. And that's a big waste of taxpayer time. That's a waste of your time.
It sounds more like you're just scared we won't affirm it.
I'm not. So that's option one.
If it's as clear as you're saying
it. I have yet to have someone argue to us that we shouldn't do our job because it affects the taxpayer when you as litigants are the ones bringing cases that affect the taxpayer. I mean, that seems like a crazy argument to me. And if you thought that we weren't going to do the right thing, maybe you should have brought a federal in the first place. I mean, that's offensive that we shouldn't do our jobs. I got to tell you.
I'm not suggesting you shouldn't do your job. I hope you do the right thing. I hope you affirm. But you could also, as the Supreme Court does somewhat regularly, you could dig the case and you could let the Court of Appeals stand. If you read the Court of Appeals opinion, you think there's nothing to improve upon here. This is correct in all of its reasoning and all of its application. Why would you spend the next 6 months of your lives
rewriting? I have an example of when the United States Supreme Court, I understand that they will dig cases, but is there an example you can give us of a time when the United States Supreme Court granted cert and then dismissed as improvidently granted a case solely because they agreed with the case on which they had already granted cert?
I can't give you an example off the top of my head, no, but if you search for them, there are many cases where the court has dismissed as improvidently granted, even after oral argument. For some reason, it doesn't present the question that they thought it presented. For some reason, you know, it's not worth their time to spend rewriting the opinion that they review and think it's correctly decided. So I'm sure there are examples. I don't have any off the top of my head while I'm standing here.
Counsel, in the chance that this court decides to answer the questions before us, could you please address in particular the equal educational opportunity, compelling interest, as I think it was, I know you addressed it in your briefs. I think, you know, we've heard more about it maybe since then as well and hear an oral argument, but I want to give you an opportunity to address why you think that's not a compelling state interest.
I think the argument is incoherent, actually. So the argument is this supports an interest in equal educational opportunity. This is not an equal educational opportunity. It's an opportunity available to some races and not to others. So how they can claim that an unequal, racially discriminatory scholarship program furthers an interest in equal educational opportunity is, to me, incoherent. Now, I think what they're doing is they're looking at statistics and they're saying there are statistical disparities among racial groups. And that is true. We, of course, don't dispute that. And what they're trying to do is a program to basically force correct those statistical disparities. The United States Supreme Court has said repeatedly, many, many times before SFFA, that that is not constitutional. You cannot solve statistical disparities through explicit racial discrimination. Now, I do think you can indirectly address those statistical disparities. And the way that you do that is with a facially neutral, racially neutral program. So this program is meant for poor students. If it was open to all, and there is a racial disparity in poverty, it will sort of naturally be given more to certain racial groups if there is more poverty in those racial groups. Their expert report actually says that.
Counsel, do you think the state has a compelling interest in non-discrimination or eliminating discrimination in its programs?
Yes.
And here there's a statistic, and I don't recall if it was cited by the state or one of the amicus briefs, that non-minority students, white students, are receiving a disproportionate share of financial aid. So what I wrote down is that 76% of the aid is going to 62% of the students. Does that in itself implicate or potentially violate equal protection, that aid is outside of this program being distributed unequally and in favor of a particular group?
No. And actually, the numbers are the opposite with respect to needs-based scholarship. Their expert report says that. So this is R54, paragraph 15. And I think if I'm remembering the numbers correctly, 38% of students are minority students. They get 48% of needs-based scholarships. That's because there is a real disparity in the world about need. But if you have a neutral program that is available to all races, there are poor white students, there are poor Asian students, there are poor Middle Eastern students. If a needs-based scholarship is available to all equally, it will naturally help to solve that disparity.
So it sounds like you agree with Justice Thomas in SFFA, and you, based on your argument to us today, are telling us that the law is somehow that you can never use race.
No, I'm not telling you that.
Okay. Well, can you conceive of a program that is distributing aid money based on race where there's a compelling state interest and it is narrowly tailored?
The Supreme Court in SFFA was very clear that there are two and only two state interests.
Where's the only in that sentence?
It's directly in the opinion.
It does not say only.
I think it does.
All right.
I don't have it in the moment.
They've been identified as well.
Go ahead. They've identified two, but that doesn't mean only.
I'm pretty sure the opinion says explicitly there are only two compelling state interests that have been recognized.
Go ahead.
That's fine. So the two are race riots in prison. Obviously, that's not relevant here. And the second is remedying a specific instance of past discrimination by the government. So if they had that, if Wisconsin specifically discriminated, de jure, law discrimination, in the past, and this program was intended to remedy that past discrimination, that could be a compelling state interest. That could survive strict scrutiny. But other than those two interests, this is what SFFA says, there are no other compelling interests that the court has recognized. The one exception was Grutter, affirmative action, and that ended in SFFA. So post-SFFA, there are only two compelling interests left, race riots in prison, obviously not here, and then solving past specific instances of discrimination. They haven't even made that argument here. So, you know, that's problem one. There's no compelling interest, but they also don't meet narrow tailoring. They also don't meet the twin commands. They use race as a negative, race as a stereotype, and there is no logical endpoint. So there's five tests from SFFA. They fail all of them. If they fail one of them, the program fails, which is why I say I think this is the easiest open and shut federal claim I've ever argued. So,
Mr. Berg, I want to take a step back and just look for a minute as what I view as the white elephant in the room. And that is talking about the purpose of the 14th Amendment as it relates to education, okay? And to achieve the 14th Amendment's goal of equal protection in a society structured by racial segregation, schools were to be racially integrated, right? But we have yet to reach that goal of equality in this country and in this state, right? Do you agree with that?
Depends what you mean by that.
Well, I think if you look at any of the evidence, certainly that the state cited, even in this case, as far as the dropout rates in these schools, by the people of color who are covered by the statute. That's one example. I'll give you more, okay? I would say that 158 years after the 14th Amendment was ratified, I think it's pretty safe to say we still have entrenched racial inequality, discrimination, and racism, both in the state of Wisconsin and the United States of America. And I'll give you one concrete example and one more general. I mean, the first one that comes to mind is that just last week, the President of the United States posted a remarkably and insanely racist video of President and Michelle Obama depicted as apes. And in this state, people of color contribute to the vitality of our state, and they are thanked by facing disparities when it comes to housing, access to medical care, transportation, incarceration, financial stability, and education. I mean, do you take issue with anything that I just said up to that point?
I do. I agree with a lot of what you said. I think the worst form of discrimination is discrimination under the law, when the law treats individuals differently based on their race. And that's the first thing that needs to end, is discrimination under the law. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to get rid of discrimination under the law in this program.
I understand that. I mean, do you agree with me? I understand that's your position. Do you agree that education plays a central role in breaking the cycle of racial inequality?
100%.
And that, more specifically, grant programs like the ones we're talking about in this statute could help people of color stay in school by helping them financially?
100%.
So I don't understand then how your position does anything but achieve the opposite result, because I see it as only denying students of color a means that is currently available to them to help address a very real race-based gap in dropout rates. And if we ignore that gap exists in attrition rates, which I feel like you're asking us to do is just ignore it. And that I see you shaking your head. So I want you to respond to this, but we're not going to solve the problem. We only exacerbate it. Well, you know, more students of color are going to be forced to drop out of these programs. And my concern is that your argument basically asks us to stick our heads in the sand, to ignore race-based gaps in attrition. And somehow that is going to achieve the 14th Amendment's goal of equal protection. I don't see how that happens. I don't see how that doesn't only make the problem of attrition worse and drive us even further away from true equality, both in this state and in the country as a whole.
I'm not asking the court to ignore that. There are disparities in statistics, and I think we should all be concerned about that. But there are poor white students. There are poor Asian students. There are poor Afghani students. There are poor Palestinian students. There are poor Egyptian students.
So, counsel, is it just a tailoring problem? Because it seems to me that you acknowledged a few minutes ago that the state does have a compelling interest in eliminating racial disparities in the attrition and graduation rate.
No, I don't.
That it needs to have race-neutral strategies for eliminating those disparities.
No, I didn't.
Is it a tailoring problem?
It is a tailoring problem. It's an everything problem. It's all five of the tests under SFFA. So it is a tailoring problem.
So do you or don't you think that the state has an interest in eliminating when the evidence is plainly out there? There are significant racial disparities in the attrition and graduation rates among the technical college students. So does the state have an interest in examining and addressing and eliminating those disparities?
No.
And why not?
Because the US Supreme Court has said that repeatedly over and over and over again for decades in numerous cases. We've quoted 9 of them in our brief, I think.
So the state has to tolerate discrimination.
The state can't use explicit race discrimination in the law to solve statistical disparities. Now it can do other things. One of the things it can do is a needs-based scholarship open to all. So if there is more poverty among Black students, more of those students will get the needs-based scholarship. That is in fact happening today under this program.
So the state could do indirectly what it cannot do directly. Is that
correct? It cannot have explicit race discrimination under the law. It can target racially neutral criteria like poverty, and it can solve those disparities indirectly. Give the scholarship to every student that needs it. If there are more poor Black students, more of them will get that scholarship.
So could the state enact a statute that says we recognize that there are extreme racial disparities in the attrition and graduation rates among our technical college students, and for that reason, we are forming this financial aid program, distributing this aid based on low income status, lack of home ownership, attendance at poorly performing high schools and first generation college students, you know, you name it, a set of criteria that attempt to target the same population that the current race-based criteria are targeting. Would that be constitutional or not? Can the state attempt to address that purpose?
The answer is maybe, and that could run into a different problem. So if everybody is explicit that our intent is race-based, that is unconstitutional. So if all the legislatures say, dear diary.
So the state has to ignore the fact that there are, in fact, severe race-based disparities in enacting legislation?
It can't have a race-based intent. Now, what it can do is it can say, we should help poor students, and more of our poor students are Black, more of our poor students are Hispanic, but we want to help all poor students. And there are some poor students who are white, and there are some poor students who are Afghani, and there are some poor students who are Palestinian. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a program that is targeted to poor students. That's what this is. But we're going to make it open to all, and it will naturally help those groups that where there is a disparity in poverty.
So you don't even need strict scrutiny. I'm back to the question I asked you before. It sounds like you say race, you're done, except for what you think are the only two problems. Those are the only two precedents that has been identified. I don't know of any case like this that's gone up to the Supreme Court. But getting back to what counsel on the other side talked about at the beginning, what if we had a maternal fetal health issue with Black babies dying at a higher rate than white babies, which by the way, we do have, I know, significantly, Are you saying the state couldn't target that? Because if they use the word race, if they say the word black, we're done?
No, the state can talk about that problem. What it can't do is enact into law.
Try to solve it?
What it can't do is enact into law an explicit racial discrimination into the law.
Okay, so
it
how
can
would
say,
it solve that problem if the purpose is to help black babies live who are not living at the same rate as white babies? How would they do that without mentioning the word black?
They would pass a program that applies to all babies that need it, and it would mostly apply to the black babies if that's the real problem, but there are some white babies in the world who might need that program too, and so you would make the program available to all.
That is shocking. And that's if that's what our U.S. Supreme Court wants to say, that is shocking. But I don't think that that's what they said in SFFA.
That is what they said in SFFA. That's what they've said in dozens of cases over decades.
Counsel, you heard my question to Attorney Gibson about standing. I guess after her response to me, my question to you is, are your clients harmed by the grant program in any unique way?
They are harmed as taxpayers. That's our basis for standing here, is taxpayer standing. This is the heart of taxpayer standing. So taxpayer standing applies to an illegal expenditure. That's what this is. It's an illegal, unconstitutional expenditure. And what this court's decisions have said repeatedly, numerous decisions, that taxpayers are injured in one of two ways. There's an illegal expenditure and it's held invalid. That could make taxes go down if the expenditure goes away. So that's one way that taxpayers are harmed. But even if it doesn't make taxes go down, taxpayers have a separate interest in ensuring that their tax dollars are spent in a legal way. And either of those interests could apply here. It actually depends on the remedy that you all decide to adopt. And this is true of every equal protection case. So when there's an equal protection violations, there's two ways to remedy it. You can level up or level down, which means you open the benefit to all, or you eliminate the benefit entirely, and you let the legislature decide if it wants to enact a new one. I don't have a strong opinion on which remedy is appropriate here. I think the Court of Appeals got it right, but I don't have a strong dog in that fight, so to speak. So if you level up, open the program to all, it's not gonna affect the total tax base, but it will ensure that tax dollars are being spent legally. So it will remedy the harm to our clients. If you eliminate the program like the Court of Appeals did, it will reduce the tax base and it will save money for the taxpayers. Either way, they have standing here. And I think that's pretty clear under this court's precedents.
Let's go back a little bit to your request that we improvidently grant this matter. I just want to make clear, this court definitely improvidently grants cases and has on a pretty regular basis, at least in the almost 20 years I've been here. But even last June, we heard oral argument in Scott Van Odenhoven's case, 416 with second 547. And on that was February 13, and on June 24, we filed a PC improvidently granting it. I dissented to that because I believe the issues were squarely presented to the court. But it certainly is an option to the extent that people might believe that it's not an option the court might employ on a routine basis. Not every case, of course, but there are several. So that is not an implausible ask. Let me ask you this, though. I think your argument is SFFA applies, and we should decide it on that basis.
Correct.
Is your other argument that the court could decide it, even if the court were to say there's a compelling interest, but it's not narrowly tailored, or would there be a problem with the court deciding it on that basis?
No, that would be fine. Our argument is there's no compelling basis here. Argument one, there's no narrow tailoring for a bunch of reasons. Argument two, it violates both of the twin commands under SFFA. It uses race as a negative and race as a stereotype. And there's no logical endpoint. This scholarship has been in place for 40 years. There's no evidence that the legislature is actually doing any sort of meaningful review every 2 years. They're just passing along the same budgetary allocation every 2 years. There's no criteria at which this thing will end. There was no statistical case originally 40 years ago that there even was a retention crisis in two-year technical colleges and private colleges. All the evidence was about four-year universities, the UW, totally different animal, as they conceded below. Okay, so not even clear what is being solved by this program, and it's been in place for 40 years. So if it hasn't solved whatever that problem was by now, it's not doing the job, and it's not going to do that. And so, you know, it clearly needs to end now, I think, under SFFA.
Council, I have a question about the stereotyping and the negative, I can't remember the word used in the opinion, but the sort of using race as a negative. The programs here, as I understand them, are, you know, they're financial aid programs. And my understanding is that the monies are distributed to the technical colleges and universities for them to administer. No student is, again, as I understand the program, forced to accept the aid under these programs. The students apply for it. They are seeking out the monies, the additional funds, which I think are from a low of $250 to a high of $2,500 each. Given that it's apparently a voluntary program, how I don't understand how that is creating a stereotype or some negative association with race and ethnicity. It's making the funds available to those who believe they may need it in order to remain in college.
So for students in the excluded races, white, Asian, Middle Eastern, right, a bunch of different races are excluded from this program, they have access to the one pot of potential scholarships. Students in the preferred races have access to that same pot plus this pot. So they have an advantage. They have more funds that are available to them to help pay for college. So if you're in an excluded race, you're being treated negatively. You have less access to resources to help pay for college. And there are poor white students, and there are poor Afghan students, and there are poor Palestinian students, and there are poor Asian students. So that's the negative. In terms of the stereotype, it's the bizarre categories, okay? Why is Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam included, but not Thailand, not Pakistan, not the Middle East? You know, why is...
Well, and that seems to go to narrow tailoring, right?
That's... Sure, yes. Okay. But it's also goes to stereotype. It's assuming that simply because a student fits into these certain racial categories, they can contribute to diversity, or they can contribute to equal educational opportunity, or they have the same poverty that statistics shows on average, which just isn't true. There are wealthy Black families, there are wealthy Hispanic families, there are poor white families. And the main principle of the Equal Protection Clause is that under law, people need to be treated as individuals, not as members of a racial class. And that is what this law does. I think it's a very clear violation of the 14th Amendment. If I may come back to my original pitch.
We very much want to hear your original pitch, but Justice Bradley has a question. I want to make sure we hear that first. Go ahead, Justice Bradley.
Thank you, and Counsel, your last remark was a nice segue into my question. It seems some of my colleagues are struggling with the idea that perhaps, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Some of my colleagues seem to be struggling with the idea that this statute is designed to help people, and it striking it down means that people won't be helped. Going back to SFFA, and not Justice Thomas's views on the issue, but the court's views of what the Constitution requires, near the end of the opinion, the court, not just Justice Thomas, said the student must be treated based on his or her experiences as an individual, not on the basis of race. Before the court said that, it gave examples in the context of college admissions where, of course, the student, perhaps in writing an essay, can talk about his or her experiences as a member of the racial group and how that impacted the student's life, motivated the student to decide to pursue a certain academic path or adopt a certain goal in life. So doesn't SFFA and the Constitution itself give the answer that it would be okay for the state of Wisconsin to develop a needs-based program, and it would be okay in the context of that program for students to apply and say, for example, I came to America from Palestine. I had nothing. I had no family. I had no support system. And I'm pursuing this path of education and I need help. So it would be okay for the state to take that into consideration. But the problem with this program is that among many other racial groups, it excludes people, regardless of how much need they have, regardless of the lack of equity in a home their parents may have. They are excluded on the basis of race, and that is what the Constitution does not countenance.
Yes, that was beautifully said, and I agree with everything that was said there. The only thing I would add is pre-SFFA, the court said very clearly, in the admissions context, you can't have a quota system and you can't admit people solely based on race. So if a college take this program, just layer it onto college admissions and said, the only students we're gonna admit are Black, Hispanic, Native American, you know, Laos, Cambodian, Vietnamese, that would have been unconstitutional for decades pre-SFFA. What the court said you can do is consider race as a factor in the admissions process until SFFA ended that. So this program would have failed easily pre-SFFA. It certainly fails post-SFFA. I see my red lights on. I just would like to make one sort of brief last comment going back to my original pitch. So this is where I'm gonna break the fourth wall a bit. If this court reverses either on standing or the merits, the next thing that will happen is someone will file this case in federal court, us or somebody else. It may be a race to the courthouse, because this is, like I said, the lowest of low-hanging fruit in terms of federal claims, and it's a claim with attorney's fees attached to it. It's only a matter of time until somebody can find a client. So what will happen is the taxpayers will pay for this court's time. The taxpayers will pay for their time to litigate the case again for 3 to 4 years. Yeah. The taxpayers will pay the time, federal district court.
Counsel, that is such an inappropriate argument. It is so inappropriate and disrespectful to the state and their program that they are here to argue in front of us. It's basically a threat to us. Don't appreciate it.
Sounds like a threat.
You could say it in any case.
Counsel, we have to decide the case based on the law and not what we perceive the costs might be to taxpayers.
Correct.
Don't you agree?
Correct. And I'm not.
Or whether or not you might decide to appeal it to another court.
Correct.
Right.
And I'm not asking you to circle this into taxpayer standing. But one of our arguments for taxpayer standing is a case from this court called McConkie. And that court in that case said, even if there's no taxpayer, even if there's no standing, sometimes we will decide important issues. One of the reasons we will decide important issues is because it will get filed again in a separate case. And that implements, that affects judicial efficiency. There's a cost to that. So that's what I'm talking about here. There's going to be an enormous cost. This program is going to be struck down eventually. And that's sort of the deep irony here. If you hold that there's no taxpayer standing, the real world effect will be a massive hit to taxpayers. Thank you.
Attorney Gibson, rebuttal, please.
Yeah.
Counsel, while you're coming to the podium, I just have one small question for you. You mentioned in your principal argument that there were certain findings of fact to which we owe deference. Procedurally, isn't this case though here on summary judgment, so we wouldn't owe any deference to any trial court findings? The trial court's opinion is, you know, interesting and informative, but certainly we're not required to accept any of its view of the summary judgment evidence here.
Well, the plaintiff said to the trial court that there were no disputed facts. So to the extent there they've come here today to suddenly dispute them, I think it's too late for them to do that.
That may be, but I think you said we need to take the trial court's findings as phrased, but this case is here on summary judgment, so there are no findings to which we would owe any deference.
Fair enough, but if the court had itself found that there were disputed issues that precluded summary judgment, the court certainly could have done that, and he did not.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I just want to make sure we're on the same page that how the trial court frames things doesn't matter for our purposes. Whether there's disputed issues of fact does, you know, I suppose, but, and I'm not saying there's an argument that there are disputed issues of fact, but I'm just trying to make sure I get clear based upon your statement earlier that we need to defer to what the trial court said, and I don't think that's correct.
It was necessary for him to find those facts credible and true in order for him to read.
Right, but we owe no deference to them, is the point, right?
I think given the procedural posture and what the plaintiffs, how they chose to litigate this case, I think for this court to reassess those facts would be inappropriate here. But I want to quickly make, I'll call it 3 points. One is on the federal court review issues. One is this case is not going to the Supreme Court because the plaintiffs, as they've told us from the beginning, don't have Article III standing. If the court needs a citation on that, I'm happy to provide it. The second, and I think Mr. Berg recognizes that, he says,
Gibson, I hate to interrupt you. Will you just put the microphone down a little bit? I want to make sure we can hear you. We're also live streaming this and recording it for posterity.
Is that better?
Much better. Yes.
I'm so short. Okay.
So then we're
you have a choir here. And barely adult size here. Okay. Second, Mr. Berg says, well, somebody's going to go to federal court. They'll start in district court, but it'll have to be somebody with a concrete injury for Article III standing. So at least that court will have the benefit of looking at the harms and the issues here.
We're not too concerned about his threat. Why don't you move on?
And I'll view
it as a threat.
Please.
Okay, fair enough.
It's reality. Sometimes this court has been reversed by the Supreme Court.
And then it's not clear to us at all that SCOTUS will decide it differently. And I point the court back to Robert's conversation and his rebuttal to Justice Breyer and parents involved. And finally, we appreciate Mr. Berg's candor on the repercussions of the ruling they're looking for here. The Court of Appeals decision was radical. No, I'm not aware of any court in the country that has come up with a ban this categorical that would impact things like medical research that's targeted at a particular racial group that's suffering from specific health outcomes. But that's, and I appreciate, because that's exactly what the rule of law they're looking for would do. Okay, second, a couple of corrections on SFFA. As Justice Dallet pointed out, all it said was that the majority had previously recognized those two. It didn't say there are only two. It didn't reject Justice Kennedy's. And second, I want to touch on endpoint. As I've said before, we don't think that the SFFA plus factors, as I'll call them, apply in this very different context. But on endpoint, if it did apply, it's the reason that those sort of arbitrarily picked years mattered in the college admissions context is because when you have these diffuse goals of future leaders, nobody knows when you've really met your goals. There's not a quantifiable way to measure it. We have the very opposite situation here, where we have a quantifiable way both to measure the problem and we have a quantifiable way to measure the solution. And if either piece of it isn't there, the legislature can choose at any time just merely not to fund it. They don't even have to kill the statute. I'm sorry.
The acoustics in this room, nobody ever knows. My voice is floating out there. When you're talking about that, are you referring to the fact that the identified disparities in the attrition and graduation rates are something measurable, and at some point, if they no longer exist, that would be, you know, mission accomplished? Is that what you mean?
Correct. Or even if they start approaching, I mean, you don't have to get totally even, but even if they start approaching.
Counsel, your argument today has been entirely about the educational opportunity, compelling interests. You have not made any effort to defend the diversity, purported diversity, compelling interest. Are you abandoning that argument or do you still hold to that argument?
We're not abandoning it. We think that the equal educational opportunity is much simpler and much more consistent with the original goals of the program. And so that's what I'd like to focus on today. And I think is the best course for the court. And then I also wanted to respond to Mr. Berg on the idea that only race neutral aid is permissible, and my red light's on, so
Yeah, why don't you make that last point and I'll see if anyone has any questions after that.
Okay. So factually, we know that doesn't work. And they have conceded the disparity. Look at page 10 of our brief where it goes through all the concessions they've made, conceding that these disparities are a significant problem and they exist. And second, that's a categorical ban. The precedents don't require the categorical ban they're asking for this court to do. The court would be out in front on this, and there's no need for the court to go there. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any questions?
I do have one follow-up question. On this equal educational opportunity, compelling interest that you're putting forward as a new approach. Your opposing counsel, Mr. Berg, says that that's internally incoherent because it's giving the benefits on the basis of race, not equal, or alternatively, it is taking racial disparities and trying to close those through a race-based program, which is not a compelling interest, and that the Supreme Court's been very clear about that. I wanted to give you an opportunity to respond directly to that argument.
Right. On the first point, Mr. Berg is confusing means and ends. He's looking at the method that we've chosen, which is these scholarships, and saying only these people can address it. The question for compelling interest is whether we have these huge attrition differences for these groups. That's the question. That's the compelling interest. And then second, Mr. Berg tells us that many, many Supreme Courts have held that it's not okay to try to address those kinds of inequalities. And I don't know what those cases are. In their brief, they talk about quota systems, but this is not a quota system. This is not a situation like public contracting or college admissions where we're saying we need 10 people to be in this spot and we're gonna take away 10 people who would have gotten the spot instead. All we're trying to do is to correct inequality and the opportunity to access programs that the state is choosing to offer.
Justice Bradley, do you have any follow-up questions?
No, because I think there's been some confusion about what FFA says and what it does not say. The case says our precedent outside the circumstances of these cases, meaning college admissions, our precedents have identified only two compelling interests that permit resort to race-based government action. One is remediating specific identified instances of past discrimination that violated the Constitution or a statute. The second is avoiding imminent and serious risks to human safety in prisons, such as a race riot. The court goes on to say our acceptance of race-based state action has been rare for a reason. Quote, distinctions between citizens solely because of their ancestry are by their very nature odious to a free people whose institutions are founded upon the doctrine of equality. That principle cannot be overridden except in the most extraordinary case. When I quoted that earlier, counsel, you ascribed that to Justice Thomas, but that is a direct quote from FFFA majority opinion. So my question for you is, what precedent of the United States Supreme Court has identified a program like Wisconsin's as constitutional?
Well, there's a lot packed in there. I can respond, is that right?
Please do.
So first of all, Your Honor's quotations and Students for Funded Fellowships is just remarking that those are the cases where there were, you know, five solid votes on the same identified compelling interest. The court never says, and those are the only two, or to the extent we've suggested there might be others, we're striking those down right now. It didn't even say that with respect to diversity, which sure would have been easy to do in the context of the case there. They didn't do any of that. So I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on the meaning of that. When I talked about Justice Thomas, I was talking about somebody who explicitly says categorical ban, what you heard from Mr. Berg today, everything has to be race neutral. There can't be anything else. I think Justice Thomas even talks about like a Black student group being unconstitutional. That's not okay either for him. That's a whole different world. But even for students for fair admissions is only about those zero sum affirmative action situations where we're taking that finite competed for benefit and giving it to one person instead of another. And that doesn't touch upon all these other ways that the state can choose to help groups in very specific ways based on race.
And that's the problem with your argument, because as I quoted earlier from SFFA during the argument of your friend on the other side, at the end of the opinion, the court says quite explicitly that people are to be treated as individuals, not as members of a group. And you can design a program, the state can design a program that will have the effect of benefiting people from certain groups, but you cannot categorically exclude people who need the same assistance or whatever the program is. You can't categorically exclude them because they happen to be a member of the wrong race or the wrong color. You have to treat people as individuals. Do you read SFFA to say something other than that?
Yes, I certainly do, because if Students for Fair Admissions, I'm trying to avoid acronyms, it had intended to create such a categorical racial ban, it could have just said that. Instead, it came up with used the traditional strict scrutiny test and then had its plus factors that apply specifically in the affirmative action college admissions test. There would be no need to have a three-part test if it was just a per se no.
Okay, thank you, counsel, for your all of our questions. Court is adjourned. We'll meet post conference in 10 minutes or so, whenever everybody's ready in the conference room. Thank you. We're adjourned.